Hi, I'm Heather Mulder.
And I'm Janice Greeno, and you're listening to Dementia Untangled, where we explore the topic of dementia through conversations with physicians, experts, and community leaders.
Our discussions focus on innovative ideas, practical strategies, and proven methods to guide caregivers along a supportive path.
Hello, and welcome to Dementia Untangled. We are so glad that you've joined us for this episode of our podcast.
Today, our conversation will be with Michelle Grigaitis-Reyes, who is a nurse practitioner with Banner Alzheimer's Institute. And we're going to be discussing sexuality, intimacy, and dementias. You know, I think it's really important that we untangle this topic because there's so many levels of complication that come with it. You know, it calls into question our morals, our vows, so many different levels come into play here.
It's so true, Heather. You know, a family I was working with recently experienced this, and it's something I actually saw in person. And this couple had been married for so many years. They'd raised this beautiful family, and he had had a really successful career. And when I met them, he would flirt with other women repetitively. And even he would even ask them out in front of his wife. She was amazing. She was truly an exemplary woman, full of grace. She was so kind. But I can only imagine how hard it was for the family and for his wife of so many years to experience this from this individual that they had known. And he was so different through the other years of his life.
And this is a topic that is often so difficult for people to discuss. I mean, it's not one that we share sometimes even with friends if something is happening with regard to sexuality and intimacy. And now that we throw Alzheimer's and other dementias on the top of that, I think people really have trouble discerning, you know, what should I be doing in this situation? What are the options? How should I handle these sort of situations? So I'm really excited that we have Michelle Grigaitis-Reyes with us here today. Michelle, before we get started, could you tell us about your journey? What really led you to connect with the dementia community? And even more specifically, what led to your interest in intimacy and sexuality in dementia?
Thanks for having me, first of all. And when I've you know, been a nurse for many, many years. I've been a nurse practitioner for 20 years. And in my very first job as a nurse practitioner, I was in a department of neurology, and I was working with a patient. And this particular patient, her husband had Alzheimer's disease. They were probably early to mid 70s, very Catholic. This happened to be a Catholic university that I worked for. This family was very Catholic, and she came in with her husband to the clinic, and I was working with a physician there, and you could see they had multiple, probably 7, 8, 9 children, and you could see that she was under a fair bit of distress. So at one point in the visit, she had said to the physician, you know, my husband is constantly approaching me for sex and he just can't perform, right? And part of that was medication and part of that was many different things, but you could just see how difficult that was for her to even mention this as a problem. And the physician completely said, oh, well, you know, he'll stop after a while. It completely blew her off. And what I saw was a woman who really stepped out on a limb to try to make a very, very difficult conversation for her based on her own social setting, and was completely shut down. And she never mentioned it again in all of the time they came. I still to this day, like, I remember that. I was so struck by that because I just felt it was so awful that we didn't hear her and we didn't help her or him.
Wow, what an impassioned story. And I can't imagine the courage it took for her to come forward to her physician with this concern, and then to kind of have it be shut down must have made it so difficult for her, especially when intimacy and sexuality is such an important part of life throughout our lifespan. And it's unfortunately that society is kind of making it taboo for us. Can we kind of start off the discussion with the basics? Can you tell us what is the difference between sexuality and intimacy?
Sexuality is, sexuality is different from sexual activity, right? So at its base, sexual activity is pretty simple. It's any activity that either self-stimulated or, you know, co-partnered, that is engaged in a sexual act, whatever that happens to be. Sexuality is really more a global sort of who we are as human beings and as in terms of basic human needs. And intimacy is even a larger sort of, you know, how we connect with the world and how the world connects with us. And it's a misnomer. Frequently people, they confuse intimacy and sexual activity specifically. Those are two very different things, but they're also perceived very differently based on some pretty basic concepts in terms of social structure. So I want to really kind of define those first, because that will help with understanding how we, like, through what lens we are looking at when we see a behavior to determine if it's, you know, sexual or intimate or what it happens to be. And quite frankly, if it's right or wrong. To begin with, we really have to define them because I think frequently we use them interchangeably. And second, they really are the base from which our views stemmed. So I want to define specifically ethics, values, morals, and mores. Ethics, when we hear people talking about what is, quote, ethical, usually they're talking about right versus wrong, but actually that's not really true. Broadly, ethics is a branch of philosophy that seeks to address issues in terms of how they're viewed. And there's an entire school of philosophy that focuses just on ethics. The next term would be values, right? So values really is considering someone or something to be important or beneficial. So we, in addition to ethics, in terms of the right, if something is right or wrong, we also have to incorporate our values. For example, if we say, oh, that's a really good value, that means we think there's benefit to that. So it actually comes from a French word, which is valoir, which means to be worth. Values are worthwhile to us, or we feel they have worth. Morals are different also because they're specific to an individual. So each person's standard based on many things, but still belong only to the person. So morals are concerned with right and wrong behavior and the goodness and badness of character. So a person's standard of behavior tells them this is acceptable or this isn't acceptable. So that's a moral. And so when people talk about immorality, they're talking about things that are wrong, right? They are it is not acceptable in their perspective for that behavior, whatever happens to be. And mores is really more of like public morals. So if we say that morals are individuals, right, we think about this is morally acceptable or it's not. Mores are like it's customs of a particular group, right, or moral attitude. So religious doctrines are an example, right, that govern social behavior. Or think about restrictions on certain foods or fasting or other religious mores. So as I said, or maybe I didn't say, but I am also Catholic. So I recall when I was growing up, you couldn't eat meat on Fridays. And then later, so this should tell you how old I am. Later, it was only during Fridays during Lent. So not only are mores determined by a group, but clearly they can change also. So we have to think about that when we think about somebody's sexual behavior and whether or not it's right or wrong.
So when we're thinking about sexual behavior and intimacy, and we're thinking about ethics, morals, mores, values, sometimes that in itself is just very complicated. I'm wondering if you could go to the to address what's going on in the brain. What areas of the brain are implicated in sexual behaviors and functioning.
Sure. So when we talk about those kind of the constructs of what makes behavior right or wrong, we always have to say, you know, behavior comes from the brain. That's why it's so interesting to me, because what makes it right or wrong, or what we think about it, is much different than whether or not it exists, because we know it does. Because the frontal lobe, so that's where our inhibitory mechanisms are. So for example, if you have damage to the frontal lobe, or you have somebody with a frontal temporal dementia, the frontal lobe is kind of it's our little Jiminy Cricket, right? It's the part that says, no, it inhibits us from behaving in ways that are not acceptable. If you have a dementia that affects the frontal lobe, you're frequently going to see sexual behaviors. The temporal lobe, that's where emotional and intellectual interpretation of sexual arousal is located. So in the temporal lobes, that's where emotion. So in, again, frontotemporal dementias, that's really, you're frequently going to see issues with the demonstrative sorts of behaviors, inhibited behaviors, because those are the parts of the brain that are responsible for sexual arousal and inhibition. There are circuits in the brain, they're called cortical striatal circuits, and I won't get into specifically where they're all located, but it is theorized that some of these obsessive compulsive behaviors originate in the cortical striatal circuits. So sometimes you'll see folks that have a behavior, frequently sexual, that is repetitive or compulsive, and that's where it's from. And then the hypothalamus is a part of the brain where, if there were to be a lesion, you can see an increase in sexual behavior.
So it sounds like, you know, sexual behavior and even intimacy come from a variety of different areas that can then be affected by dementias. But even though maybe that urge or that need for a sexual behavior changes, there's still a need for intimacy. Is that right?
That is absolutely correct. So when folks early on in all dementias, generally speaking, early on, that's when you can start to see a kind of mismatch in sexual desire for a lot of different reasons. And for example, with caregivers, they're frequently completely overwhelmed with just the tasks of caregiving, right? It is a very difficult role to have. And so, but that doesn't diminish their need for intimacy. It may impact their desire for sexual activity, but it doesn't diminish their need for intimacy. The same with the person with dementia. As that disease progresses, the need for intimacy doesn't, it may change in how it's being expressed, but the need is always there. The sexual activity will change over time, but the need for intimacy is always present.
I like it that you shared about that situation. And I wondered if you could just share some more about other situations. I've heard about hypersexuality and then also the loss of drive.
So hypersexuality is not uncommon. There are some medications that may make that worse. So I usually sort of try that. But the other thing is, so sometimes it's true actual increase in sexual desire or libido, and other times it's literally memory loss, right? So you can have a couple where the husband or wife or the partners have, you know, they have sexual activity, they make love, have intercourse, however they tend to look at that act, and have a complete loss of recollection an hour later and think, okay. And then they're asking again or making overtures again to have additional sexual activity, which can be really, really, for the individual who doesn't have the dementia, it is very frustrating in the first hand, because they feel as if they've already met that particular need themselves. Secondarily, though, it just is another example of a loss of the ability of their partner. And third, frequently you'll see just they're devastated because they, you know, typically when you share an intimate act like intercourse with a person, you expect that to be meaningful. And when the person comes back to you with no recollection at all, that can be very, very difficult for the caregiver to accept that. So it's best to just really put it out there in practical. I'm a very practical person. So I say to folks, you know what, get a calendar and identify however often is, you know, appropriate for you as a couple, when you want to have sexual activity. So then if you're approached, demented person is approached for sexual activity, they can say, oh my gosh, no, it's going to be Tuesday and I'm so looking forward to that. And, you know, I bought some special flowers and it's going to be lovely. You're not saying no to the person, but you're also having, you know, you're allowing that caregiver to have their own space. The opposite, right? So lack of desire, that can be part of the dementia itself, quite frankly. In that case, sometimes we can look at that, but others frequently we have to look at the caregiver to say, okay, now it's time to look at what are some ways for you to meet your needs without perhaps your partner. And there are lots of ways to do that. And then you have to go back and look at what we talked about, the mores and the morals and what within their construct would be appropriate. And there are many, many ways to meet sexual drive needs that, you know, don't require another person or maybe, you know, involve another person, but that isn't the partner, whatever that happens to be. But those can be very, very difficult decisions for the caregiver to make.
Well, and you kind of touched on this, but I'm hoping maybe you can elaborate a little bit more when it comes to kind of that desire for the other person. As the dementia progresses and this caregiver takes on more and more responsibility, I'm thinking, you know, really of a spousal caregiver, that level of desire for the person, because of it's not as much a partnership anymore, the level of desire will change for that person.
It can very well. And I think more in terms of the sexual activity piece could change. But the intimacy piece is still necessary for both of them. So frequently I will try to look at how are some ways to foster intimacy that don't necessarily involve overt sexual activity.
Maybe we should just talk about those. What are some of those ways that people can foster intimacy?
Excellent question. Lots of ways, actually. So if we think about, you know, primarily touch, almost anything that involves touch is an intimate act and it can meet that need. So something as simple as holding hands, right, while sitting on the patio watching the sunset, that is a very intimate act. I had another patient story that I have. I had a gentleman who he was married, you know, multiple decades to his wife, and she was a very particular woman and always very prim and proper with her presentation and her appearance. And so he was able to, he went to a local department store and asked at the makeup counter to learn how to put makeup on so he could put his wife's makeup on in the morning. Now that is a very intimate act, right? It demonstrates the care that they have for their partner without this sexual piece. So that's really fabulous. Dancing, right? That can be a very intimate act. Foot massages, you know, combing someone's hair, shaving, you know, your male partner. Those are all intimate acts.
It really kind of seems like intimacy, when we're giving these examples, is really kind of tapping into the five senses.
Absolutely. That's absolutely true. And so if you think about what are the five senses, well, we see things, we hear things, we smell things, we taste things, and we touch things. So how, you know, just a cup of coffee can be a very intimate act, right? So when you use you get into somebody's physical space and you have the coffee and you hand it to them and you hold your hand around their hand on the cup, that's the definition of intimacy, right? If you think about that on a cold morning, that sounds fabulous. It sounds fabulous to me, actually. So yes, any of the senses you can use to engage in intimate acts.
Your story about the gentleman who went to the department store and got a lesson in how to put makeup on, went home and did that for his dear wife. It's so powerful. And I think about intimacy, and we sometimes, like you had said, we get it mixed up with sexual behavior, but that we have this need to know and to be known and then to be acknowledged. Can you talk about, well, how do you fill that gap when the person with dementia no longer is able to acknowledge their caregiver or their spouse the way that they used to?
Again, touch is powerful. And what do we know about the dementias? In general, emotional memory is relatively preserved, right? So they can re-experience something that is emotional, such as an intimate act, that isn't necessarily a cognitive memory, right? So you can have pleasure in things as the disease progresses. That's when you start to maybe use taste a little bit more, to sort of the mouth and the tongue are very sensitive. Maybe, you know, you like some chocolate or some lovely pudding or something, and you help them eat. That can be a very intimate act that they can sense themselves. Now, in terms of what becomes problematic frequently is the inability for the person with the dementia to meet the needs of the partner that is not cognitively impaired.
You know, something that's occurring to me, and something that you've been talking about with this intimacy and feeding pudding and doing makeup, there's this need for presence in the moment. Maybe just going, like you're feeding someone and it's a task, but it really also becomes an intention and a presence in that moment.
No, you're absolutely right. It really is all intentional, because there's a difference between a paid caregiver feeding someone and a spouse who comes to the facility every afternoon and has lunch with their loved one. The outcomes are the same, right? The person with dementia has lunch. But how that happens determines the difference between meeting an intimacy need versus meeting just a basic human need. And where this comes into play is if you meet the intimacy need of that person, for example, in a facility, the expression of what is identified as, quote, inappropriate behaviors is markedly less than the person who is just being fed without the focus on intimacy.
That's so interesting. And, you know, you bring up another term that I wanted to discuss, which is kind of inappropriate sexual activity. I feel like that word inappropriate is used inappropriately often in this context. Could you kind of clarify for us what really is truly inappropriate sexual activity?
Inappropriate is sort of like ethical, right? People use it in a way that is not really accurate when they really mean moral, right? But they say ethical. Same thing with inappropriate in this context. So sexually inappropriate behavior typically is, and it's in the dementias, when you see it, it tends to be sort of, generally speaking, mid to later in the disease, has a lot, lots of times it's people exposing themselves or, you know, doing self-stimulation in public places or, you know, chasing the other gender around and, you know, asking for sexual activity. And frequently it is very important to identify whether or not someone has an unmet need, basic human need that they can't articulate. For example, both in the home setting as well as in facilities, you frequently will see folks disrobe. And the thought is, oh my gosh, that's sexual. Well, not necessarily. Like, it's sexual from your perspective, you, the onlooker, but perhaps the person really is constipated or has to urinate, but they can't really articulate that, but they just know that they're uncomfortable somewhere down there, right? So that's where their hands are. But our assumption is, oh my gosh, that is self-stimulation, when in reality, many times it isn't. So it's important to evaluate the behavior to make sure that it is not actually a different behavior, like perhaps a woman with a urinary tract infection or things like that. So frequently that is an issue and needs to be addressed. But that, because we had said earlier, I think, and if we didn't, we needed to have said that sexual activity is normal throughout the lifespan. So if you have a 75-year-old gentleman who is not having, he's not having his intimacy needs met and he's not having sexual activity, the fact that he's masturbating in the, you know, common area shouldn't be surprising. Frequently it is surprising to people, but it really shouldn't be, because nobody's really looking at, well, we need to meet his needs. So the first thing I always tell people is, let's look at, again, intimacy. How are we meeting his intimacy needs? Are we holding hands with him? Are we, you know, what are we doing? And then at the very least, again, this goes back to people's mores. Is masturbation acceptable in the room with the door closed? You know, I tell people the determination of appropriate versus inappropriate is harm. If it is not harming themselves or someone else, then I have difficulty identifying it as an inappropriate behavior.
Michelle, once the behavior has been evaluated, sometimes behaviors like this are taboo. And so are there dangers to ignoring inappropriate sexual behavior and just brushing it off?
Well, I don't know that I'd call it inappropriate, but there's definitely a danger, right, in ignoring these demonstrations of intimacy needs not being met, right? Because if we don't do something, it's going to escalate. For example, if the person actually has a urinary tract infection, that's going to be a really big problem, because then they're going to develop a delirium and it'll be a big mess. Or if it's because they truly do have an increased libido, well, that's an issue too, because they have disinhibition and we need to address that. By not addressing them, I we're also doing a grave disservice to the person, right? Because again, intimacy needs really need to be met. And once we meet those, a lot of what is identified as inappropriate will diminish, right? Because they're getting their needs met. Now, that's not to say that, you know, there's not true inappropriate sexual behavior that's aggressive or harmful. And although that is a very, very small percentage of people, and in those cases, we use pretty significant medications to address that.
Michelle, what should we be watching for in the way of behavior to cue us in that maybe, whether it be sexual needs or intimacy needs, are not being met in our person?
I am famous within my patient population of saying, you know, they'll tell you. We just need to know what to look for. They will always tell us. Sometimes it's easier than others to figure out what's going on. So when you start to see, for example, the person with FTD that's disinhibited, so you can tell just by what they're saying to you. So what do we do? Well, we need to institute a lot of intimacy strategies, as well as look at things like, just like we do for other behaviors, right? What, you know, is it, does it happen more commonly at a certain time of day or on a certain day or around certain people or whatever that happens to be? So we identify that, we evaluate it, and then we intervene based on that. So we look for, you know, as time goes on, you know, is the person, you know, are they coming out undressed because they've forgotten how to button up a shirt or because they're exposing themselves? Well, almost always it's because they've forgotten, but sometimes it's because of a disinhibited event. So we just have to sort of keep track. And again, if we're meeting intimacy needs, if we are being intimate, so I guess it's hard to identify or quantify how do we meet some, how do we know that their intimacy needs are met? So it's really better to look at how can I be present intimately every day? Like, what is one thing I can do each day that I know is going to be an intimate act that will help meet both our needs?
Wow, Michelle, this has been such an interesting discussion and on a subject that I think people oftentimes have trouble bringing up and discussing. So I thank you for your forthrightness and your insight on this. Before we go, do you give us your final thought when it comes to sexuality, intimacy, and dementias?
What I would say to the people listening is that, number one, there is no wrong answer here. The real task is to find a place where you can talk about these things, which are perfectly normal. And so I would strongly suggest that you try to have a conversation with your healthcare provider. And if they give you sort of the same that they gave that woman back 20 years ago, maybe give a little pushback or say, who can you refer me to? Who can I talk to about these things? Because I want my loved one to be comfortable too. It's just another way to advocate, which is what you do all day, every day for your folks anyway.
Thank you, Michelle. Today, our conversation has been with Michelle Grigatis-Reyes, nurse practitioner at Banner Alzheimer's Institute. We appreciate you helping us untangle the topic of sexuality, intimacy, and dementia.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Michelle. It's been a pleasure having you today.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Dementia Untangled. Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Dementia Untangled is hosted by Heather Mulder and Janice Greeno, produced and edited by Amber Ayers, and is brought to you by Banner Alzheimer's Institute and Banner Sun Health Research Institute. We are supported by generous donations to the Banner Alzheimer's Foundation.
Please visit our website at banneralz.org and follow us on Facebook to learn more about upcoming events. If you have questions or comments, please email us at dementiauntangled@bannerhealth.com.